one thing that I had learned, and I didn't learn it till later on, or maybe even realize it, is no, in a life of crime, you have to have multiple personalities, okay? And, you know, on the street, you have to be this cold-blooded killer at times, or shrewd person, you know? And then there was this, and I talk about that side of my father, you know, anything my father did, he put his heart into and did it and put everything into it. And so even if it was killing somebody, you know, he liked to be hands-on and up close and make sure the person was dead. So he'd like to get them close. He'd like to strangle them. And then he'd like to cut their throat from ear to ear just to make sure they're dead.
And then he approached you, his son, and tried to bring you, did bring you, into his life of crime.
Yeah.
What did he say to you?
Well, it was never like, hey, you know, son, did you ever think of, you know, when you get out of high school, did you ever think of joining organized crime with me? Or, you know, I mean, I could never have been a MAID member because I'm half Irish and half Italian. But in my family, you know, my Irish side grew up in the Irish mob and my Italian side in the Italian mob. He never came to me. It was little menial tasks that he asked me to do, and until I bought into it, and then it was like the norm for me. You know, I believed in my dad, and I believed in what I was doing. And once he got me to that point, it was coming to the time where, you know, if I needed to kill somebody, you know, I had to be ready to kill somebody. He wanted to take me in full time, and that's what I did for a while.
But as you moved up, so to speak, his ranks, you'd be doing what? Would you be beating people up? Would you be...
I did anything you could think of but kill anybody. Anything we had to do, if somebody had to be roughed up, breaking their legs or slapping them around. A big thing that we tried to stay away from violence as much as possible, okay? Because if you start going around beating up everybody that's owed you money, they can't work, and if they can't work, they can't pay. So, you know, there's not as much violence as people think. Because we were to a point where people knew what we were capable of, and they didn't want that to happen to them. So they usually did as we said. It was very, very few and far between when we had, you know, a lot of times there was a message, you know, burn a car, break a window, kill an animal, a rat or something, put it on their car hood, hang by the front door. They usually got the message, but when they didn't, a lot of times it was a crack to the side of the face, and my father had a lot of different ways he'd show us how to knock a guy down and get over him, and once a guy catches, we call it a crack to the side of the head, and he's on the floor, you got his undivided attention, and that's what we would do. Very, very seldom would we ever actually have to break somebody's legs or really hurt them really bad. If it was to that point, a lot of times the person was going to get killed. A lot of the killing, you can't just kill anybody because you want to. You have to get the okay. So it's either comes down through the ranks that somebody needs to be killed, or you go up the ranks and you ask, hey, you know, this guy's got a problem. I want to get rid of him. You know, it was very, very organized for a while.
You say
very,
this,
very organized.
You say like this, like it's bringing your car for a service, for goodness sake. You're saying this in such a cold, calculated way. How did you feel when you were doing this, when you were beating people up?
Well,
did it come easy to you?
By nature, I'm a nice person. Everybody that knows me on the street knows I'm a nice person. I was always very good with my hands. I fought when I was a kid in amateur boxing, undefeated. When I'm doing it, I believed in it. Okay. Later on, when I started looking back and seeing what I was doing and seeing what my legacy was going to be, and I had kids, that's when I started thinking differently. I developed two personalities. You know, I learned to turn a switch on and turn a switch off, and it's really very, very sociopathic. You know, and that's the way it is. You know, and I still have to deal with this every day today. You know, I have to, like an alcoholic would, or a drug addict, or somebody who's obese. You know, every day I have to process in my mind when a situation comes up. Sometimes I'll think like the old Frank, and then I have to step back and process and say, wait, I can't do it that way. I'll wind up where I was before.
And soon, Frank, after all that you'd explained, you moved up another stage in the world of criminality, and you were planning your first murder.
Correct. Correct. There was a lot going on at the time. There was some leadership movement. There was in the mob. There were certain people that had to be killed. And because my father and my uncle were known for killing people, if my father and my uncle were to get in a car or show up with somebody alone, people would be alert because they're like, oh, am I going here? Am I going to get killed? So for this one, they couldn't be together. So they needed to, think of a different plan. So we sat down and we thought about, and I was all gung-ho. This guy did something to our family. You know, it wasn't about, the mafia. It wasn't about anything. It was about my father, my uncle, myself, our family. He was doing something to hurt us. And, it became clear. So I was ready. But my uncle was the first one that tried to talk me out of it. And the reason he did it, because he told me, once you cross this line, I couldn't tell me in front of my dad, once you cross this line, you can't cross back. So my uncle, I credit one of the turning points is that not committing that murder.
And you then want it out, Frank, and it's very difficult to get out. And your dad then, did he turn on you?
My dad, and I say this all the time, I've never heard too many people tell my dad no. That was not an easy word to say. Well, the only ones you would hear say no, it's like a guy saying, no, no, please don't hit me again. No, no, please don't kill me. But other than that, you just can't tell my father, hey, I don't want to do this no more.
You stole £800,000 from him.
Yeah, I did. I tell you, one of the dumbest ideas in my life, I says, it was my original intent was to take the money. He had owed me a few $100,000, and the original intent was to take the money and make money and return the money. You need money to break away and start a new life somewhere else. So that was my original intention. The problem at the time, though, was I wasn't thinking 100% clearly because it was the 80s, and I started getting into powder cocaine. And because I have an addictive personality and because I was, in the criminal world, I says, oh, wow, I see an opportunity to make a lot of money here with it. The downfall from that is that, in Chicago, it's a big no-no to deal in drugs if you're related, if you're in organized crime, if you're in the mafia or the mob. So basically, if my father found out I was doing this, it was a death sentence. He would have killed me himself.
So you steal your dad's money, he finds out about it, and then he tells you he owns you.
Yeah, I'm trying to break away from him, and then he finds out that I took the money, and now he owns me. So I'm in the worst situation ever. I have two little kids I have to look out after and a wife, and right now I'm walking around with a snub-nosed revolver in my pocket everywhere I go, and I just don't care if I'm thinking I'm better off dead.
What does that mean when he says he owns you?
Well, he owned me. He took my businesses over. He owned my house, my cars, everything he took until I would pay him the money back. And then if he called me, I had to be there. I went through the motions for a while, and then I took off and hid. And I would run from him and hide from him. And then I go through the book talking about he'd come and find me. He just didn't let it go. The blessing that came was that we got indicted for some old stuff. And I thought everything was going to change. I says, oh, great, maybe this will be the thing that, my father will wake up and say, what, I've done enough here. I want to work out my thing with my kids, go to jail, come home, and not do this anymore.
So you saw jail as a blessing.
Yeah.
Because you saw it as an opportunity to get away from your dad. But when you went into jail, he was there.
Yeah, I needed jail twofold, okay? One, I needed to get away from my dad. And two, I needed to get off of cocaine. I needed to get my life in order. And I felt that I needed prison for me to, dig deep down inside, find out what I'm made of, have a plan for when I get out and start a new life. Like you said, though, the problem was I get in prison, I look up at the board, and I get designated to go to the same prison as my dad. And that's when I was locked down in a penitentiary in Indiana for 16 days. And locked down 24 hours a day. And in that cell was when I looked in the mirror and I dug deep down inside of me. And I says, what am I going to do here? I can't run from my father no more. We're going to be in prison. I need to face him. I need to make a plan for when I get out. And I need to keep this goal getting on because prison was good for me. Once I got inside here, I was a different person. People on the street that would come to see me, they're like, oh, my God, you look great. I says, I feel great. I'm ready to get this done. Problem was when I got to prison with my dad for 8 months when we were together, I tried to work on our relationship. And what I did was I used a lot of the street smarts my dad taught me because he was a very, very smart man on the street. taught me, and I used them against him. My biggest thing was, he said, when you're talking to somebody, every once in a while, throw in a question about something you already know the answer to, and then you'll be able to tell if the person's lying or not. And that, you know, and I did that, and every time I did it to him, he was lying. And so eventually, that's when I had to make this painful, life-changing decision.
And that was to wear a wire and stitch your own dad up.
You know, I sat down and I said, what are my options here? You know, my dad always taught me, you know, be very decisive. Don't make a spur-of-the-moment decision you're going to regret later. Make sure that you know what you're doing and think it through, think it through. The next part that was really hard is, how do I get this man who's so smart on the street that can sniff out anything anywhere, how do I get him to talk about murders? And how do I get him to incriminate himself? So I, you know, that's when I decided to wear a wire. And what my father taught me was, when you got to get somebody to talk, and you got to either get them mad or get them drunk. Well, we're in prison, so there's no alcohol or liquor. So what I did was, he was jealous of my Uncle Nick because he thought my uncle was poisoning mine and my brother's minds against my dad. So I pitted my uncle against my dad. I got my dad mad, and he started talking about all this stuff.
How do you wear a wire in jail and not get caught?
It was very, very, very hard. You know, my life was on the line every second of the day, because it's not like it's here on the street where three guys are sitting in a room and they're monitoring and listening, okay? I came up with the ideas. I sat with the FBI and worked with them on how I should be wired. You know, it wasn't just about not getting caught with the wire. It was about not being seen getting to the place where I needed to get to put the wire on, not being seen leaving that place. And I never knew if I was going to be seen or not, because somebody's going to come up and say, what are you doing? They're just going to pass the word. So every day I left that office with that wire, I believe there were 6 or 8 recordings we did, I didn't know if anybody knew or not. And the FBI, when I left that office, they just sat in that office and waited till I came back, because there was no monitoring because of the concrete walls.
And your dad almost saw the wire one time, didn't he?
He did. He did. The one time, he just got done telling me about everybody that was involved, all the top bosses of the Tony Spilotro murder. That was the one where they made the movie Casino with the Martin Scorsese movie Casino. And yeah, he just gets done going through detail, everything. And we're standing out in the prison yard, right, some bocce ball courts. And he all of a sudden tells me he wants to see this new tattoo I got on my back. Well, the recording equipment for the first time ever didn't work the night before, so they put this old-time thing. I was wired up like a Christmas tree. Had I lifted up my shirt, the whole yard would have seen it. I would have never made it 10 feet. So after that call, the FBI decided to transfer me to another prison. They felt, and then come back when I got out and talked to my father in the visiting room, because it was more controlled environment.
And if we fast forward this incredible story, you had to walk into court and face your own father.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I love my father to this day, but I don't love his ways, and I know he feels the same way about me. But, you know, I was prepared to walk in court and do this. A lot of people, when they cooperate, think that day's never going to come. I spent many hours with the FBI. I prepared myself, but there was one thing I didn't prepare myself for. The overflow of emotions that I went through when I walked in that courtroom and looked over at my dad. And that first time I seen him in about 5 years.
What was it like? And
I wanted to run and hug him. You know, here I am, his tormentor, and I want to be a savior. It was really, really hard. I sat in that chair, and I my mind was just all over the place. I wasn't even listening to the questions. And now, but the one thing that happens is my father's personality changes so fast. And he started with the stares and the rumbling and the mumbling, and, you know, and so right away, you know, that helped me get back on track. It was hard. It was very, very hard. And, it, you know, it got easier at certain points. But, God, you know, and then at the end of the trial, you know, to see him and know that I was going to see him for the last time ever alive in that room, you know, that's just, you know, it's, the emotion, I can't tell you. I sat upstairs in an office, and tears were just rolling down my face, because the emotion was just unbelievable. So hard. You know, I deal with it every day still. It's not a feeling that goes away. You know, you wish things could be different. You know, I'll be doing something out, and I'll look and I'll see a father and a son, and they're sitting doing something, and I wish that was us.
Where's your dad now, Frank?
All right, he's in Springfield, Missouri. He's in a SAMS program. It's a terrorist lockup. There's around 12 people in the whole country that are in this lockup. 10 of them are actual terrorists, and 2 of them are mobsters, one from the East Coast and my dad. You have no interaction with any other prisoners or anything, and basically you're locked down 24 hours a day. You can only get one visit every 2 weeks from a family member. And when guards go to see you, or any members of the prison staff go to see you, they go in twos so they don't get compromised.
Do you ever go to see your dad?
I cannot. We're not allowed to see one another. Would I go see him if I was allowed? If I knew that he finally came to his senses and, you know, he still thinks he's a victim. He thinks he's a victim.
I don't even know where to go with that. This man that killed so many people effortlessly thinks he's a victim. Just finally, Frank, what does this tell you? What have you learned through this? Have you any regrets?
When you say regrets, are you talking about regrets going against my dad or regrets things I've done in life?
I guess I'm talking about both.
Okay. I wish I would have stood up to my dad at a younger age and followed my dreams that I had, you know, that I wanted to do. As far as cooperating against my dad, people tell me it's the right thing. There was no right thing there. It was about survival. It was him or me. I needed to survive. I needed to get home to my kids and take care of my kids. You know, my dad was already planning people to kill. You know, we're on tape, and he's talking about, when you start working for me, you get home, I want this guy gone. I don't like him no more. So I made a life-changing decision to save my life and my kids.